This episode is brought to you by Sterling Soap Company. How often do you think about your soap? Well, if you answered, not much, maybe you should. You see, a lot of what passes for soap in stores is technically not soap, according to the FDA's definition. It's full of lab-created chemicals and detergents because, well, it's cheaper to make. Now, what if you could buy natural soap made from natural ingredients like tallow, palm oil, coconut oil, and scented with essential oils, and for just a little more than you'd pay for grocery store soap? Sterling soap is 100% natural, and with a wide variety of bath soaps, shave soaps, beard balm, lotions, and cologne, there's a product and a scent for just about everybody. Check them out for yourself at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLING soap.com.
Looking for the perfect gift for that basketball fan in your life? Well, I've got a book for you. It's called Basketball Now. Newly updated for 2025, it spotlights 50 of the NBA's top stars. Think fast breaks, clutch threes, and buzzer beaters. Captured in stunning photography with sharp, readable analysis. From rising stars to veteran icons, this book is a courtside pass to the game right now. Wrap up a slam dunk this holiday season and pick up your copy of Basketball Now today at your favorite bookseller.
Tonight we'll go back in time to seasons past when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Sports History Network in conjunction with Swick Enterprises. And we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We'll cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. At this time, I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larger. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Captain, great to be here. The eve of the national, my friend.
Yeah, I got done packing just a few minutes ago before the show. I'm ready to go. I got a bunch of Gridiron Greats magazines I'm going to be handing out to some friends and dealers there. Great. I look forward to elbow to elbow with Pokemon collectors there.
Think about how much extra room you have in that suitcase, because all you need is a Bart Starr jersey and some Gridiron Greats t-shirts.
I really hope when I get there, and actually I'm not going to the show until Friday and Saturday, but I truly hope when I get there on Friday, I am not inundated with the Pokemon.
Captain, let's flip that around. I think you should really get more involved in the Pokemon community, just to be a man of the people, just to be in touch with the day's youth, just to become a little more woke.
I refuse. I've been doing football since 1965. I am not stopping for any fad. I didn't stop for Beanie Babies. I didn't stop for Pogs.
But you were a big Cabbage Patch guy. I remember that.
Cabbage Patch, Funko Pops, you name it. I've dealt with it in 45 years of doing shows. And I think because I'm older now and I'm more irritable over certain things, it's the Pokemon craze that really drives me berserk. A real quick story. I got contacted by a guy in Myrtle Beach who's running a 2-day, it's not a Comic Con, it's something con. So I said to the guy, I said, listen, just tell me straight out, how many sports card dealers are you going to have? And does anybody have anything older And he says, well, I really don't know how many, I don't know how many sports card dealers I have, but I know I got a few, and I got a few tables. So I said, okay, so this is a one-day show. How much is it? And it's a six-foot table. He says, well, it's $100, but right, you get two pieces of pizza and a soda at lunchtime, because there's going to be so many people, you're not going to be able to get away from behind your table. So I told him, well, straight out, I need to go to the bathroom during the day, so I really don't have any alternative other than leaving my table. I will have somebody covering it. But I said, if there's nobody going to be there buying sports collectibles, what's the purpose of me going? You know what I mean? So I politely declined him, and he just said, if I get more sports dealers, I'll let you know. And that's it.
I'll tell you what, I'll work on an article for Gridiron Greats on Pokemon just to kind of introduce it to the people. And by the way, I 25 years in construction, I know I carried a Gatorade bottle around with me just in case I found myself in between bathrooms. Maybe you should put one on the table there.
I know. That could be my latest prop at shows and the thing and the like. So.
But pretty exciting week. I texted our football nerds text group that I got my SWIC Enterprise envelope with the goods inside, my newest Gridiron Greats magazine. REA auction opened up. They've got a Bronco Nagurski 5 that looks a little thin on the right edge there. BBCE just opened up their auction. Not a lot of football in there, but they probably take most of it to the Natty. The National coming up, as we just mentioned. And then Heritage Auctions just opened.
Right.
And we got a preview of that about a month ago, but the Dan Fouts personal collection is up for auction in there. A lot of jerseys, a lot of football. Ball games and some personal trophies and stuff. I've got my eye on a few Dan Fouts collections. So, you know, I'm a huge Dan Fouts fan. He lives in Oregon here.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. I was surprised. I didn't realize he was letting go of his personal collection, but obviously whatever reason, I understand that, should be some good pickups for collectors out there from his collection.
Dan needs a new pool, maybe. Who knows? There's a couple jerseys. I've told you my goal is to get Dan Fouts over to our house for a barbecue someday.
Yep.
So I think the greatest sign of fandom would be a personal jersey of his collection that I bought at Heritage hanging in my living room.
I agree 100%. And you can
nothing says I'm a creeper like one of his personal effects hanging in your living room.
You could also ask Drew Bledsoe to come over, since you met him at that other event. I'm sure you could have a meeting of former NFL quarterbacks.
Yeah.
At compound in Oregon. So that would be
amazing. Just amazing. I love it. Well, I love it. Well, if I've done anything, I've gotten you to pronounce Oregon properly over the 15 years of this show, Bob.
I hear you. I get it.
But yeah, some really cool Dan Fouts things. I've got the Heritage, auction open here. Two of the classic blue and gold jerseys that he's auctioning off, along with, like I said, a lot of game balls. But he's got a commemorative Oregon Duck jersey that they gave him for the anniversary. Helmets, his Pro Bowl jersey. And then an away uniform that's white and, that's white background that's going for significantly less. Obviously, the home jerseys are worth a lot more.
Right.
Kind of cool to see what was in there. And like you said, you never know why somebody lets go of their personal collection. Maybe it's cluttering up the house. Maybe it's time. I mean, who knows? Dan Fouts is 75. That's pretty young.
Yeah.
He looked in great shape when we had that dinner with him a couple years ago.
Exactly. In that same auction, I believe there's a 77 Mexican complete set in VGEX condition. It'll be interesting to see what that goes for. I think it's at roughly 36. It's 35 or 3600 right now. I'm not sure. So it'll be interesting to see how much that goes. And then again, you got to add the 22% buyer's premium.
Mm-hmm.
May or may not be a deterrent in a set like that, because it is in lesser condition. Yeah. So some guys might think twice bidding because of that 22% juice that they're going to add to sales tax as possible, and obviously the all-encompassing shipping and handling.
There's also two must-haves for diehard Green Bay Packer fans. There's a 1923 stock certificate. It's already at 8,500, estimated at 30,000. And then something you don't see very often, an actual 1965 Green Bay Packer championship ring from safety Tom Brown. Not a salesman sample, didn't go to an office person. This is a player who played, and it's their ring. Pretty interesting. Yeah, 30,000. I've always thought it'd be interesting to buy one of these rings, like a Pro Bowl ring or something like that, and then wear it into a bar in Hawaii during the Pro Bowl and just kind of pass yourself off as a football player.
As a former player.
And then Christmas is just around the corner, Captain. So I've got the watch on that Green Bay Packers stock certificate and Super Bowl, well, not Super Bowl, championship ring. So fingers crossed.
Well, the stock certificate, I have always thought that's a $20,000 to $40,000 piece because it is very rare. And because there are a lot of Packer fans out there who do want that as part of a collection. I mean, obviously, mine is much older, my stock certificate from them. And as such, you know, it's more of a conversational piece than anything else. But at the same time, finding original paper from the NFL is a pretty, tough task, to say the least.
Yep.
So, I got one right by me.
We'll find out about that later in the show. So,
we just heard from our guest a little early.
NFL 1923 NFL certificate signed by Joe Carr and Carl Stork. Original.
That is beyond rare at the same time, too. But
this is stock number 182 for 10 shares, signed by Curly Lambeau. All right. Pretty interesting.
And I'm also going to be interested to see if I see anything at the National that is pretty unique. So I'll be reporting on that while I'm there. I'll be doing a few tweets and some stuff on VFC also if I see anything. But again, by the time I get there, two prime days of buying tonight, it opens at 4:00. So you're going to get a lot of people buying. And tomorrow there's going to be a lot of hardcore collectors there.
Yeah.
Buying
there was one time, I think it was the Baltimore National. I think I showed up on like Wednesday and they were still setting up. Most of the booths weren't set up yet. Scott Alpaw got me in a little early. That's when he worked for, with Leighton Shelton. I forget the name of the company.
Yeah.
Got me in a little early on a pass. And I wandered the halls as people were setting up, and it was probably the best. So is there like Wednesday night, Thursday, and Friday morning? And by the time the show actually opened on Friday afternoon, I was bored. I was like, oh man, I don't like this show with all these people in here. It's a lot better when it's empty.
Yeah. Baltimore was a nice location because the hotel was right connected to it.
The ballpark is right there. The stadium. Yeah, that was a great location. No idea why it doesn't go back there, but I would imagine it's this.
Well, they booked the time frame for the National. They have it pre-booked already by, I believe, a coin convention. Mm-hmm. And lost it after whatever year it was. 2012 was probably the last year there. But I did it in the last two Baltimore conventions I was there and set up. So, that was a good show. And that was a nice show when we were in Connecticut. We just drove down. It was easy commute, stayed right there, just wheeled all the stuff in. It was nice. It was an easy show, to say the least.
Now that I'm looking at your backdrop, that stock certificate would look really good there.
I'll try it next show. I'll move it around.
Over your right shoulder, hanging on the wall. Get Brenda to, there we go. That's perfect, right there. Love it.
I see your large in area there. I'm sure you picked up on it immediately.
Absolutely. I've got an eye for such things, Captain.
All right, our special guests are here, and I'd like to introduce them and get into our show tonight. We have two special guests tonight. Our first guest is the great-grandson of NFL co-founder Leo Lyons, who passed away when he was 9 years old. And he does have memories of him. He inherited hundreds of pictures and documents along with memorabilia from his grandfather, great-grandfather. He has spent the last 25 years researching Leo Lyons and the Rochester Jeffersons. I'd like to introduce Mr. John Steffenhagen to our show. John, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you for being
on. Our next special guest has co-authored a new book about Leo's involvement with the NFL. And he's the author of several books, including Pop Warner, A Life on the Gridiron, 100 Things Bills Fans Need to Know and Do Before They Die, Game Changers, Rockin' the Rock Pile, Buffalo's Forgotten Champions, and the Iceman Kamehameha. I'd like to welcome Mr. Jeffrey Miller to the show. Jeff, thanks for being on the show. And men, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
I love those book titles, Jeff. Nice job.
So I want to lead off by asking you both if you could tell our audience how you got interested in football.
Well, I'll go first, I guess. I grew up in a racing world. My dad was a NASCAR driver. It was all about racing. And when Leo had passed away, my mom inherited tons of boxes of Leo's items that did not go to the Hall of Fame. Joe Horgan, who had just started at the Hall of Fame that year, showed up at his house with a tractor trailer and loaded up the truck. But before my relative or my aunt, my brothers, or my mom, dad, and uncles didn't know that my great-grandmother had called the Hall of Fame to come get it all. So they went there to grab a bunch of stuff to keep in the family. So that's the stuff that I have. So over the years, I started picking things out of these boxes and started to have a interest in football. And then it just cascaded on.
Wow. Unbelievable.
I can't believe that. A lifetime of collections. And it was a step away from being practically given to Goodwill. I mean, yeah, the Hall of Fame coming up. I mean, that's so interesting.
Yeah, it was. There's so much. I mean, for instance, I have a first aid kit that was used during the first six seasons of the NFL. It was given to Leo by George Eastman because he wouldn't sponsor. He didn't believe in pro football. But I had that thing sitting in my garage. It just got paint on it. I mean, it dented. I mean, I thought it was, you know, just an old relic, an old piece of memorabilia, but not memorabilia as in the first six seasons of the NFL. I only thought that it was just some piece of junk from his past. But all the things I have are incredible, and the stories behind them are incredible.
Well, just even more, just think about the financial instability of a program that keeps the same first aid kit for 6 years. There's the story about the Chicago Bears. They would have to wait for gate receipts to come in to run across to the street to the drugstore to get Band-Aids and bandages.
Yeah, it was definitely a different time. There's no doubt.
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. Jeff, how about you?
I became a fan of the Buffalo Bills back in probably 1968, 69, just before OJ comes in. I started becoming aware of the Bills because I would sit with my father. I was 7 years old, and I would listen to him curse out Jack Kemp or Harvey Johnson because the Bills were really bad in 68. But in 69, obviously, OJ comes, and everybody who's a kid in Buffalo and Western New York just falls in love with the Bills and OJ. And we had season tickets when the Bills moved into Rich Stadium in 1972. My father got season tickets, and we've had them in the family ever since. And, I've been going to games there. So it's just been, a journey ignited, like most of us, by our fathers, because our fathers were fans and we became fans. And that's kind of what happened to me. And I played Little League football. My father was a coach, and I just continued being a Buffalo Bills fan all the way through.
Mm. Wow, that's cool.
And, boy, and you ripped the bandit right off and got into O.J. Simpson.
Oh, yeah. Hey, you know, still one of the greatest running backs of all time.
Absolutely.
True.
Yeah. The you guys both have a litany of books you've written, but I mean, I absolutely adore people who dive into subjects like this that a lot of people hadn't heard of. Like before the show, I was saying I hadn't heard of Leo Lyon, excuse me. You know, it's Joe Carr who gets all the publicity. So when I saw this topic, I'm like, that's incredible. I always tip my hat to people who do the deep dives on the NFL history and then put it in writing for the rest of us to enjoy. So your new book, we didn't get, we didn't get a picture of the cover or anything like that when you sent the bio over. So tell us about your book and how you, how you came about writing it.
Again, back when I was into racing and then started going into these boxes, I'm seeing pictures of Leo with Vince Lombardi, George Halas, with their arms around each other. Wow. And again, I didn't know, I heard of Vince Lombardi, but I didn't really know who he was, and because I wasn't into football. So basically, I would pull him out. But exactly like everybody says, nobody knows who Leo Lyons is. So I'm thinking, I've never heard of him. I've never, I can hear the big names. I don't know. So he must not be that big of a deal. But then when I started looking through documents and seeing letters from Jim Thorpe and started researching, I'm like, wait a minute, what do I have here? And it frankly quite scared me. And like, wow, has all this been sitting in my, my closet for 20, 30 years?
Wow.
So I joined the PFRA and met Ken Crippen and Jeff. And those two really guided me from early on to start discovering who Leo was.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So he stayed at, I mean, the team went under, I forget when, 25, 26, but he stayed, active in the NFL after that.
His story, I can't even, like I say, it would take weeks to explain. That's why when people say, who Leo Lyons is, it would take a while because he's so interesting. I mean, for being a kid who grew up not around football but was obsessed with football, who would write down, I have his journal notes, and he's writing down in 1908 about forming a pro league. And here he is on a sandlot football team in Rochester. And he starts devising logos. He actually has in a logo of Jim Thorpe's uniform from 1912, the shield that's on Jim Thorpe's shirt. He has that drawn in diagrams, and he was calling it Major League Football. So he had the shield, and he had an MFL or whatever, MLF, across the logo. And it was things like this. And then he ended up turning the team by himself into state champions. And then friending Jim Thorpe and guys out west in the Ohio League, because he knew that was his only shot to do it. So here's this kid, 16 years old, who literally willed his way into being a part of the NFL, which that's only the beginning. And then his involvement with the shape of the football cards. We have the letters of him communicating with Joe Carter. Open up a museum because he had been collecting things. There's the Green Bay Packers. He's got a letter where he's talking to Lambeau and his last name is J-O-H-A-N-N-E-S, Jonas, or one of the owners there at the beginning, the Packers, the GM. I know it's Jonas or Jones. I can't think of his name, but he's got a letter there saying, hey, you guys got some photographs or documents you don't use any longer. I'll collect them. So Leo is actually behind the Hall of Fame all the way up. I have letters to every single commissioner, including Elmer Layden, where Leo's like, hey, I've got thousands of items in my house. You need to open a museum like Cooperstown. So there is a huge involvement after his football team. And we were saying about how I was little, and he died when I was 9. Well, when I was 8 years old, I was over at his house because they lived nearby. And two old gentlemen had come over during the summer in long coats and ties and cigars and hats. And I only knew them as a couple of old guys. And my mom told me later on that that was George Halas and Art Rooney during the summer. It was 75, I guess. That was the year Steelers won the Super Bowl. And wow. And here he is over at Leo's house. And I was like, and then as I got older, I'm like, wait a minute. Why would these guys be over at Leo's house if we just had a team that lasted for a few years in the NFL and they sucked? Well, it's because of they know the background, Leo, from the very beginning. And it's mind-boggling how much stuff Leo was involved in. And wow. Those guys they knew it. They knew that George, when I went to the Hall of Fame 20 years ago, I brought up, do you guys have it? There's no mention of Leo Lyons here. And they're like a bunch of guys that were working there at the time. Actually, it was a young Jason Akins. But they were like, no, I've never heard of Leo Lyons. He goes, but you know what? One thing that struck me as odd is that there's a George Halas induction speech in 63. And he goes, George Halas mentions only like 4 men. And one of those 4 was Leo Lyons. And he goes, I was always wondering, who the heck is Leo Lyons? So wow. It's just like that. And you could go on and on forever. But this guy is like, he's a little bit of everything throughout time, his whole life.
I gotta point out one thing. I was going to bring it up later, but since you mentioned it, I was just so in shock reading his letters in your book about coming up with a football card set. And he was paralleling it to baseball, the Cracker Jacks and the tea card, the tobacco cards. And he wrote to National Chickle and he wrote to George Eastman. And sadly, both of them rejected it because they didn't think it was going to be popular and sellable at the same time. So again, for those who really know football cards, we look at 1894, the Mayo Cup plugs, which were actual football cards of the college players in the cans of Mayo Cup plug tobacco. And then theoretically going to 1935 to the National Chickle when they actually came out with their one and only football card set. You had a couple of regional things in between, postcards, so on and so forth. But I was just blown away because I did not know that in any way, shape, or form.
Great insight.
We could have had a card set in the 20s of professional football players because of Leo Lyons. And yeah. That is something in football card history that is the first time I ever heard of it. And I've been involved in the hobby theoretically and since I was a kid. I had never knew that. I never knew that information. And that just blew my mind when I saw that.
We have the blueprints too. He has I think one of the pictures is in the book, but he's got I've got the actual, his documents, his plans, where he has an old Cracker Jack card. It was somebody from Brooklyn, I believe. He's got the actual card. I have it on a piece of paper where he's got lines and diagrams and talking about background colors. I mean, details from a kid, just like mind-boggling. And to him, it was very simple. He said he saw his brothers and sisters love baseball. They had the trading cards. It was so big. He's wow. like, why not football? Why not the college stars even? And even he went to Parker Brothers to do he wanted to do a board game. Yeah. I mean, it's mind-boggling what he did.
Yeah. Well, think about that. George Halas was one of the founders as well, with the Staleys. I mean, he probably saw Leo, as a peer. It's like, because without Grange, the Bears would have folded. Without Grange, the Giants would have. There's a lot of teams that wouldn't have made it. I mean, so he probably just saw Leo as a peer who didn't quite make it. And hey, let's go catch up,
Yep.
That's really interesting, but he's 75.
But Jeff was instrumental because the problem was I had these thousands of documents and stuff, and I didn't know how to put it together. I mean, it was like so expansive. that it was like, I want to get this right because this is historical things. I had the Chicago Bears call me and ask me who I was because I had the oldest NFL football from their first game at Wrigley Field against the Jeffersons. They're like, who is John Steppenhagen? So I had all this massive stuff. So Jeff was extremely instrumental, and he was so professional. I'm just so proud of him of what he did because it had to be done right. You know, I had collectors who wanted the were offering me crazy amounts of money for these things, and I'm like, no, I cannot get rid of it. This is historically important.
That's right. That's the real history of the league and the real history of your family. I mean, that you can't put a price on that kind of stuff. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's something.
Yeah. But yeah, Jeff, I just wanted to say that Jeff was, he put it all together. It was so good.
That's amazing. So that leads me to our next question. So how easy and or difficult is it to co-write a book like this? And again, with the amount of information you guys went through, and to me, it's the type of book, once you start it, you don't stop it. I mean, I did it in two nights. I mean, I couldn't stop reading it. And it was another thing. Brenda's yelling at me, are you coming to bed tonight? And I said, well, I got to read a couple more pages, just a couple more pages. And it was just really just incredible, incredible historical, never before historical view of the NFL. So how easy or how difficult was it with you two guys putting it together? And I know, Jeff, you're a football historian, if there ever was one. You know how to handle books, and John, with the information you have, I can see how you could be totally overwhelmed with everything you got there. So how did it work for you guys?
Go ahead, Jeff.
John had asked me a while back to help him with this, but I'm a Buffalo Bills guy, so you know, I was always in the middle of writing another book about the Bills, and finally there was kind of a lull, and you know, I had just finished another book, and I was looking for something, and John started corresponding with me, and we've been corresponding for the last 25 years, and he said, you know, I really want to get this done, I really want to do this, so he sent me a couple of things, and I started looking deeper into it, and I just, you know, the story became more and more fascinating to me. So much that not just that we didn't know, but that we're seeing the formation of the NFL and the early pro league or the early pro game from a perspective that other than like Joe was talking about, Joe Carr and George Halas, they're the ones who told the story. You know, the victors always tell the story. You know, in a war, whoever wins is the one who tells the story. And since George Halas is the last man standing, he's, of course, the authority. He becomes the guy who tells the story. So everybody, you know, tells it from, oh, George talk, remembers, you know, drinking bootleg beer in buckets on the Hubmobile running boards. Okay. That's one perspective. Leo has letters back and forth with Ralph Hay and Jim Thorpe. And discussions with, you know, all these people. He knew George Halas before the meeting happened. He knew these people, and he was corresponding with them. He details everything either in his journal or on the back of a Saturday Evening Post magazine. Right. He'll just write all his stuff down. So he talks about when he left Rochester, on what train, when he gets to Canton, what hotel he's going to stay in, what time the meeting starts, who was at the meeting, who was standing next to whom. It was just such a different, more fulsome story than we ever got from George Halas. Joe Carr wasn't even there. So he wasn't at the first meeting. You know, so the principal players were Carl Storr, Jim Thorpe, Frank Mead, these guys. You know, they were all there. But Leo is telling the story from a different perspective, talking about Ralph Hay having the good cigars, or you know, George Halas turns to Dutch Sternman and says, drink some more beer, you know.
Yeah.
We don't have those stories. These are fascinating little insights, and they don't mean a lot in the best configuration of things. But, man, what a fascinating story. And the more I'm learning about this, like the trading cards and the Hall of Fame and the football and the Red Grain story, I'm like, I'm looking at this. This is fantastic. This is fascinating. And I wanted to be the one to tell it. I thought I can take all these pieces and I can put it together. John's already done, you know, 75, 80% of the research. I, you know, it's all there. I just have to kind of put it all in its proper order and make it make sense. And, you know, while we're writing the book, you know, I'm principally the one writing it, but John's the research assistant, so to speak. And so if I get stuck on something, or if I hit something that I wasn't sure was accurate, I would shoot off an email or call John and say, listen, I'm stuck on this. I don't know if I can write it, because how can we back this up, or how can we verify it? And John would go out and he'd find something in Leo's journal. He'd find a newspaper article. It was something, and it was all. So we were able to back up every claim and every story with two or three different sources. And it was just, so, you know, it just became this airtight story that seems very Forrest Gumpish, but is totally true. And it was fascinating. Now, there were times John and I didn't agree on things. There were times when he didn't like the wording that I used, or, you know, he thought I should have included something that I didn't. And sometimes we'd go back and forth with this, but generally speaking, you know, we got along pretty well. You know, there were times when we disagreed, but it was a very good collaboration.
Well, I just gotta say this. I'm reviewing the book for the fall issue of the magazine, but I did read it. I got the ebook that they sent me from McFarland there. And again, I mean, you could have not done a better job, honestly. I mean, it was like complete. It just blew me away, because there was stuff there I had never heard about before. And I thought, I think I know football and football history. I'm ignorant. That's the way I got to say that. And
that's kind of the way I was looking at it. Like, I didn't want, you know, someone, you know, I have a lot of author friends. I have a lot of historian friends in the PFRA and across the country. I didn't want one of them. I wanted to be the one with the scoop. You know,
it's
John's story. And I'm glad, you know, I wanted him to tell it, but I wanted to be part of it. I wanted to be the one to be able to go along for the ride, so to speak.
Right. And that was a heck of a ride. That's all I got to say. I mean, that was.
And even, I'm sorry to interrupt, but even when Jeff was like, well, Leo's writing a lot of stuff about the NFL owners meetings. And it's like, you know, we don't know, maybe he's full of it, you know, and we wanted to make sure it was documented good. So I went to the Hall of Fame and I talked to John Kendall, and I'm like, can I see the owner's meeting minutes for, like, you know, the first 10 years of the NFL? And luckily he let me, you know, research and look through them and write stuff down. And so we had actual minutes, and we were both shocked at how much Leo was involved with, like, the talk about divisions. And there was a lot of stuff there, though. Like, where did that, like, I had no idea.
That's incredible. I love that, just crib notes, just like a personal diary on what happened today. It's like, you know, Stedman drank a lot of beer and we smoked good cigars. There's a story on the landing page that talks about Red Grange, him trying to bring Red Grange to Rochester. I mean, and so it's surprising that Hallis is still friends with him for that, because, I mean, that saved their team. Imagine imagine how the structure of the history of the NFL would look if Rochester would have landed Red.
Yep. And the stuff that he was so obsessed, I mean, I've got it's a Time magazine.
There you go.
It's the original.
1925. Yep.
Yeah. So not only would Leo collect things, he'd put little notes on the back. And sometimes we wouldn't even see them. They were so faded. But down at the very bottom here, he says, bona fide crowd pleaser. And he says, the bear will be, like, set up for the next 10 years. I mean, he's writing these, like, you know, when it's happening. It's neat to see in his head these historical moments.
Yeah. Wait, what's the story there? How close did they come? Because you read Red Grange bios, you know, with C.C. Pyle involved, and there's never a mention of Rochester. So, I mean,
exactly. That's part of the story, too. You know, Leo was talking about signing Red Grange a year before it actually happened.
Wow.
And there was a game in Illinois where he got injured, and he thought, oh no, his career might be over. There's actually notes that John has from Leo where he wrote that, you know, hopefully he'll be okay. And then Leo, again, documents his entire effort, you know, his entire journey to sign Grange. And he talks about driving or taking the train out to Wheaton, Illinois, to meet with Doc Cooley, who was the manager of Red Grange before CC Pyle. He met with Red Grange's father. They assured him Red was going to sign with the Jeffersons. He's got this all documented. The catch was Leo had to come up with a lot of money, and I'm actually going to let John tell the story because this is one of my favorite stories, and I just get crazy.
I get excited too, but reading, nobody knew like the relationship George Halas and Leo had. Now here you got Red Grange coming out. Well, Halas and Leo had been writing for years as friends. So now you've got this topic coming up, Grange. And so I have letters where Halas is telling Leo, look, Leo, he's not going to come to Rochester. It's like, you know, I've been talking out here. CC Pyle is starting to take over. It's like, he's going to follow the money. Don't waste your time. And Leo would tell him, I can't not. He goes, my team's about to fold. I'm desperate. He's like, so you have these actual conversations about Thor. And not only that, Leo goes, I guess somewhere along the line, Halas goes, how are you going to afford this? And so we came to find out, I actually have a check. He was going to the mob in Rochester and putting up his house for collateral and trying to sign him. I mean, he was doing the craziest things. And then when he went to the Giants, he played the Giants at the Polo Grounds. He was having conversations with Tim Mara about those two colluding to get Thorpe away from Halas, even though Halas was Leo's friend. It's just amazing. Like you can't make it up. I mean, it's just so twisted and
generational star. It's a franchise saver.
Yeah.
Right.
And every franchise it touched when Grange came to town, they would draw 60,000 fans. I mean, in LA, 10,000 fans went to see the Wildcats, largest NFL. I mean, that was a conundrum.
Yeah, that was a conundrum basically with Rochester and Leo's failure, is that he at the time had this great semi-pro team, Sandlot team, semi-pro. But then when it came to the pros, when he joined the NFL, he knew that he was going to have to get rid of all those guys, the locals, and start with all the college all-stars. And Rochester was 100% against bringing in unknowns, like people that they don't know. So it was basically a revolt. It was in the newspapers, like, Leo, we don't want any more of your college stars from Texas and everywhere. So they basically wouldn't come out, so then Leo couldn't afford the players, so he would lose them. And it was just like a 6 seasons in the NFL that he survived were amazing. He was doing it, working 3 jobs, and he had Eastman Kodak right around the corner from his house. And George Eastman was giving out millions and millions of dollars to charities, the music schools, the dental schools. And Leo met him several times and said, look, this is going to be big. Would you please just help us some? And he said, I'm not going to give you a penny because I don't believe in pro football because it's tarnishing college. It's rotten. But it's just the whole thing is just so crazy.
Wow. That's a great story. That's the kind of stuff that literally just having a diary of every little nuance like that is incredible. And that's a piece of football history. What other, it's kind of funny. You see, people doing book tours, on talk shows. And I'm sure there's a PR person who's constantly telling them, it's like, you always have to refer to the book. Like, well, in the book, I talk about this and stuff. So I don't want to dip into anything that's in the book, but I mean, are there any other, amazing stories as you're digging through this, years of NFL history, literally, that were really cool that didn't quite make the cut or maybe did?
Well, the one story that I found fascinating occurred in 1916. This is the year the Jeffersons win the state championship. They were playing against Buffalo, and there was a disputed play. And at the towards the end of the game, the referees colluded and they decided we're gonna award a touchdown to Buffalo that they didn't really deserve. And then at the end of the game, because they never got a chance to kick the extra point of this after this touchdown. They kicked the extra point after the game was already over.
Yeah.
And ended up, so the Buffalo people claimed the title, and the Rochester said, well, no, that doesn't count. So basically, you have these two cities that were disputing the state championship. So Leo says, well, you know, doggone it, I'm going to settle this thing because we can't have co-champions and we can't have them disputing our championship. So talk about gall. And, you know, he writes a letter to Walter Camp, of all people, the godfather of modern football, right? Walter Camp. And he tells him the situation. He tells him what happened. And within a week, he gets a response from Walter Camp. And Walter Camp says, your description is absolutely correct. They should not have been awarded the touchdown. And, he publishes it in the paper. And, you know, the Jeffersons are the state champions because he got Walter Camp, the arbiter of everything about football, to involve himself in this and settle the championship game of 1916 for New York State. Just like that. See, Leo, he was fearless. He would just, you know, I'm going to go after Red Grange. I'm going to help start the NFL. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to get money from the mob. He just, nothing stopped him.
I agree with that. He was fearless. Just reading everything, he was such a visionary. It's just amazing to read his future vision. He knew, it's almost like he had that sixth sense of what was going to happen with football. He could predict the success of football down the road. And it's just truly amazing. An amazing story.
And it's just all the way down to the football cards. I mean, the subtleties of it.
And the story continued. I mean, last week, okay, the Buffalo Bills are at training camp here in Rochester. It's St. John Fisher College. Well, come to find out, Leo's daughter is the founder of St. John Fisher College in 1949, which she was a founder of a male college, which was unheard of.
Wow. Yeah.
Like, so now the Bills, here you got the co-founder of the NFL and the co-founder of the college. And the Bills didn't even know it. It was just coincidence that they played there. But it never ends with Leo. It's like you pull back another thing. Oh, there is his name in the newspaper. He's there. He's there. He's there. Never ends.
Wow. Just amazing. I mean, truly an amazing story, to say the least. My next question, and this is a purely opinion question. I'm reading everything about Leo Lyons, Rochester Jeffersons, the early NFL, and I know a lot of the stories of the early NFL, so on and so forth. In your guys' opinion, and I know, Jeff, you're still a big Bills fan, what's going on with the NFL today? Is it gotten too big, too many games played, overseas games? Are we just watching a marketing gimmick, or are we actually watching a game anymore? I don't. I personally, even though I'm a Packers shareholder and a big Packers fan, I have a tough time watching the game today. And, you know, I prefer watching a high school game in a lot of cases because I know these kids are playing. You know what I mean? So I'm just curious as to both of your opinions on it.
Well, I'm in agreement with you. You know, as I grew up and the Bills played every Sunday at 1 o'clock. And for some reason, Bills fans, and I'm sure fans across the country, feel like their team is being disrespected if they don't get the primetime games. I absolutely hate primetime games. I don't like Monday night games. I don't like Thursday night games. You know, I just want my team to play on Sunday so the game is done. And then I go to work on Monday feeling good because the Bills are winning.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like the big salaries. You know, it's one of the reasons why I quit watching baseball, because, you know, it just got ruined by the free agency and salaries. But I also understand and support a player's ability to get anything that they can get out of it. So, you know, if somebody's willing to give Patrick Mahomes $40 million a year, whatever it is, it's a, you know, it's a free capitalist society. God bless them. Let them do it. However, you know, I just feel like, well, you know, you're making it so I can't take my son to the game because I can't afford $500, you know,
right,
to spend 3 hours in traffic and at the stadium on Sunday. It's just, I don't like that part of it. But you know, I'm a fan. If they ever go to a, you know, everything is pay per view, I probably stop watching because I'm not going to pay money to watch a game from home.
Right.
And that's my biggest fear, that I really got a gut feeling. Next contract's coming up. Everything's going to be on, you know, a subscription type channel.
Yeah.
The regular market TV, regular cable, whatever, is gone. You know,
yeah, I think so too.
NBC for this, CBS for this, ESPN for that, mm-hmm. so and so forth. And I'm done too. I mean, I'm not going to do it. I refuse. John, what are your thoughts?
Same thing. I was just going to say, I think it's just the evolution of the game, and it just is spiraling so far forward that you can't go backwards now. So it's just the fact that it's just progressed so much, which somebody like Leo would have loved, but he also wouldn't have loved where it is now. I mean, you know, when there was a game last year, I'm a Miami Dolphins fan, ironically. Jeff's a Bills fan, but there was a game on, and it was like, oh, you could only see it on Paramount Plus through like you got to jump through 9 hoops and then you got to pay for like 2 subscriptions to get the game. I'm like, come on, that's just such greed. It's pathetic.
Yeah.
So that's that kind of stuff just drives me berserk. The you know, again, I don't know how they nurture fans that way, because you know they turned off a whole generation, basically our generation.
Yeah,
you know, anybody 55 and older who knew what it was like Jeff said, your game started 1 o'clock on Sunday. You know, I grew up in Connecticut, so I knew I had a 1 o'clock game and I had a 4 o'clock game. I knew on Saturdays I could watch college football sometimes at night because there was a third game at night, whatever. But I knew there were 2 games during the day, so 2 games during the day, Saturday, 2 games on Sunday. And that was it. And that was great, you know, and I never got excited, you know, when I was working full time that I'm going to watch a game at 9 o'clock on Monday night and then get up at 5 o'clock on Tuesday morning, 11:30. And I just took a nap for 4 hours to get up because I had to watch the Packers or whatever. I mean, that was crazy. I mean, it doesn't make sense. You don't create fans that way. But then again, I don't. You know, I'm a dinosaur with a lot of things, so that's one thing I'm definitely a dinosaur with, was marketing and trying to sell a product rather than just selling 22 guys playing the game of football and having it coached functionally at the same time.
Good point. Yeah. I'm curious, Jeff, I know you've written a lot as a Bills fan. You've had the ups and downs. I joked around about the juice earlier. I've told this story to Bob years ago. I'm a diehard Seahawk fan, grew up watching them. And I remember seeing someone wearing a, you know, 2005 NFC champion jacket once. And I'm like, NFC champion is, you know, second place. It's first loser.
Right.
So the Seahawks are 1-2 in Super Bowl appearances. And we were a... we're a beast mode handoff away from winning 2 in a row and having our dynasty, as you would say. And as they say, that loss to the Patriots, you know, that interception by Malcolm Butler is probably one of the worst Super Bowl losses in history, as voted on by me, Seahawk fan. Would you rather be 1-2 with a close call, a nail biting loss like that, or 0-4 and just rip the Band-Aid off in the 90s?
I'll take the one Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Any day. I would even take one, win one and lose the next 3. Just to be able to say we won one, you know, and we should have won that one against the Giants.
Yeah. Out of doubt. That was close.
You know, and I know Scott Norwood very well. He's a great guy. He carries that team. With him, and I've been at book signings with him and seen people come up there with pictures of that kick and say, would you mind signing wide right? And you want to look at these people like, are you out of your mind? This guy's been through a lot. He carries that with him to this day. But you know, you talk to some of those players and they'll tell you, oh yeah, we blew it. We should have been in bed by, you know, 10 o'clock and they weren't. And so they let down a community.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, the Bills were amazing back then. Thurman Thomas and Jim Kelly, you know, it's just they were stacked and they just had bad days. And just I remember Seahawks losing in 2005 and somebody's like, I'll just do it again next year. I'm like, you know how hard it is in the agency to build a team and salary caps and to keep a team together. Anyways, I don't want to get distracted. I saw one of your book titles was 100 Things Bills Fans Should Know.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, that's a tough one. So, yeah. But what a trip. I mean, just to hear some of these stories about just the notes, the daily occurrences at NFL meetings, and for Hallis and Mara to come and kiss the ring. It must be amazing to be like thumbing through an old, you know, program or a Life magazine, like you said, and you're thumbing through every page and you just see a notes on the back that's, you know, your grandfather's writing. And you're like, that's pretty incredible. I mean, it's a flash in time and something that's very important.
It is. I cherish it. I am like you guys. I'm mind boggled that it made it this far. Like, how did it not get thrown out? It's like,
oh.
it's a miracle, really. I mean,
yeah.
And if I can jump in there for a second, you know, I think about like the notes. They just add so much to what we already know. And, you'll read the meeting minutes or you read the newspaper accounts of the meetings that happened. And then you read Leo's notes and it just adds something to it. It adds this, like who was talking to whom and, you know, which guys were going back and forth and, you know, who, you know, kicking Curly Lambeau out of the league and bringing him back in or the Packers out and bringing him back in with Curly Lambeau. You know, it was there. Those notes are there. And
here's an example. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jeff.
So it's just, you know, you read about this, but, you know, Leo's actually talking to these people and he's documenting some of these conversations. There's one great story, and I think that you probably read this, Bob, in the book, where he's talking about going up to Green Bay to play the Packers, and he's talking about Curly Lambeau being able to throw touchdowns from a tractor. You know, these are observations. You don't see these in, you know, anywhere else.
Right.
It's fascinating.
Nice job, Jeff. You slid that reference in the book. Keep up the good work.
Well, all I can say, because we're running out of time, I am just totally blown away by the book. I mean, putting it in perspective, this year we're seeing three books that have come out about three old forgotten franchises that have now been revived.
Yeah.
So Maroons, the new one on the Yellow Jackets that just came out, and you with the Jeffersons. It's amazing. And I love to be a flying on the wall in the NFL, you know, control room there. And they say, what are these guys doing? They're writing, they're talking about early history. We control the history. The history is 1970 after. What are they?
That's true. The people at the Hall of Fame think they do control the history of the league. And I probably, if they're watching this, I'm probably going to get my ass kicked for it. But it's true. I mean, that's John. You know, like, he goes there and he says, what do you got on Leo Lyons? They're like, we don't know. You know, are they?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's horrendous. That's disrespecting the game, and that's disrespecting the league.
Not only that, Leo recruited in 1911 one of the first black football players in history with Henry McDonald. And I go, you know, there's nothing there really about it. And I'm like, well, this is the Pro Football Hall of Fame, right? Not the National Football League Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And then that should be in there. That's a historical pro football moment.
Yeah. I get it.
That's huge. I read that. Yeah.
All right. We're really squeezing for time. Where can our audience get your book and any final thoughts by you guys?
Well, right now at Amazon.com and from the publisher McFarland and Company, who did a fantastic job of laying it all out and made it a beautiful book for us. We're trying to get it into Barnes & Noble. We're going to be doing a lot of book signings at the local Barnes & Nobles, and we'll have the books with us. But right now it's mainly just from Amazon and the publisher.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right. And again, the fall issue coming out. I'll have my review that I'll send over and
gentlemen, look forward to the prestigious Gridiron Grape bump. You're going to need a second run in print.
Great to hear. I would love to see it.
I truly appreciate what you guys have done for football history.
Absolutely.
Just a priceless book on the history of the NFL and the man so visionary. John, you got to be proud of your great grandfather. What a phenomenal story. I mean, I get work, you know, I just think about it and just say, it's just amazing, truly amazing.
Totally.
It's amazing to see this happen now because I've known this my whole life and I just give up because I always think it's a big deal. And people are like, you only catch a little snippet of it, you know, and it's like, oh, yeah, okay. But just like, you don't know the whole story.
Yeah. Great story. All right, we're out of time. Joe, real quick, 2-minute warning in less than 30 seconds.
Gentlemen, I tip my hat to you for doing the heavy lifting and putting the history of the NFL in a book. Thank you very much for being on.
And I did on that. And Jeff, I loved all your books. I have most of them here. I pulled the one that was easiest I could pull out here behind my massive library of books.
Thank you.
I'm glad I finally actually got to meet you. Like I said, I think I've been in the PFRA for like 35 years now. So it's nice seeing some faces to names.
Yeah, same here.
And John, great job. I truly appreciate what you did for your great grandfather. The story that should be told and was told. That's great.
I agree.
All right, we're all done. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. Until next time, thanks for watching.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Hey there. Welcome to Music Meets Sports, where sports legends meet custom soundtracks and unforgettable stories come to life through music. I'm Sean, the marketing director. Music Meets Sports was created by music producer Ronald Tyke Oliver to bridge generations, educate fans, and celebrate the greatness of both current and former athletes. We craft original songs about heroes in basketball, football, baseball, boxing, and beyond, highlighting their early struggles and personal battles, their faith, character, and drive, their inspiring victories on and off the field. Across genres, hip-hop, R&B, rock, pop, even country, we reintroduce fans to their favorite athletes in a way they've never heard before. From Babe Ruth to Reggie White, from rising WNBA stars to timeless NFL greats, we give legends their flowers in full surround sound. Stream or download our music now on Apple Music, Amazon Music, and Spotify. Visit musicmeetsports.org to explore the catalog, hear new releases, and join the movement that's preserving sports history, one song at a time. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Music Meets Sports. That's sports with a Z. Music Meets Sports. The raw energy of sports, the emotional depth of music.